KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates, held as a virtual meeting during the pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Allison Berry and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
Welcome our KPTZ listeners, Dr. Berry and Willie Bentz, who's just getting all sorts of kudos for highly successful and productive vaccination clinics this week. It's all I'm hearing about. So shall I hand it off to you first, Dr. Berry?
Sure. Thank you for having me. Nice to see everybody. So as far on the COVID front, we are seeing nationally for the first time in a while, we're seeing cases rise again, which is not unanticipated with the colder weather. Right now, it's really led by the Midwest and the Northeast, which is also not surprising. It's colder there. And so I think more people came in earlier. The state leading for new infections right now is actually Minnesota, has surpassed Alaska. We're seeing a significant transmission there. We are still seeing really quite high rates of infection. So 81,000 Americans are diagnosed with COVID-19 every day. And we're losing about 1,100 Americans every day to COVID-19 as well. So still seeing very significant rates of transmission nationwide. In Washington state, the good news is we are seeing a case rates still decreasing. Actually, we're starting to see a decrease. We had been at a plateau and we're starting to see a little decrease from there. Case rates are still high though. Statewide, we're at 351 cases per 100,000. Hospital systems are still strained, though we are seeing a decrease in COVID-19 hospitalizations at this point. But the strain of the backlog of all of those procedures and all of the people who were ill who put off medical care during the most recent wave is still really stretching our hospital system, as well as, of course, some staffing shortages that we're seeing across a wide variety of industries. Those are affecting healthcare as well. In Jefferson County, we are seeing a small uptick in cases. We are at 202 cases per 100,000, or a total of 1,221 cases diagnosed at this point. We have five of our citizens currently hospitalized for a total of 76 hospitalizations in this response, and no new deaths. So we're still holding steady at 17 deaths. 73% of our cases remain among the unvaccinated. That's a number that's stayed really quite steady over the last several weeks. Neighboring Clallam County is up to 5,122 cases with four residents hospitalized, no new deaths. The case rate in Clallam County is 276 per 100,000. And in neighboring Kitsap, we're at 228 per 100,000. So all kind of meeting around this 200-250 range. In Clallam County, 83% of the cases are among the unvaccinated. I would say that the status of COVID-19 right now is that we are still seeing quite a bit of transmission, and we are in a risky time as people start to come indoors, start to plan for the holidays. The good news is we are still seeing that our same precautions work really well against COVID-19. So wearing a mask still works really well. Getting vaccinated still works incredibly well. So currently in Washington state, you are 6 times more likely to get COVID-19 if you are unvaccinated, and you are 12 times more likely to get hospitalized with COVID-19 if you are unvaccinated. So we strongly recommend all of our residents get vaccinated as soon as possible. We're really excited about opening up vaccination to kids 5 to 11, and Willie's going to talk a bit about our most recent vaccination clinic, which went quite well. We unfortunately have seen the return of some intense misinformation around the vaccine, particularly around the pediatric vaccine. So I wanted to just touch base a little bit about that. We talked about it a little bit last week about this, the buffer in the vaccine seems to have gotten a lot of attention in the kind of misinformation realm. There's been some folks sharing on Twitter that it's some kind of a heart medicine. It is not. It's a neutral buffer that's in a lot of medicines that you've come in contact with before. The Moderna vaccine, it's also in pediatric insulin. It's something that we feel very, very safe giving to children. It's not a medication. It's just something that helps it be stable and last for a long period of time. That's what we use it for. And so with that, that is most of my updates today. I'm happy to take questions and also to let Willie share more about our pediatric vaccinations.
You guys have any specific questions for Dr. Barry, or should we go to Willie first and hold our questions? Okay, go for it, Willie.
All right, so yeah, we had our first 5 to 11 year old clinic at the Blue Heron in Port Townsend, and just grabbing the numbers here. We had 192 kids come through and get vaccinated. Unfortunately, we had 6 no-shows, and then one young kid did show up, and we weren't able to get them to follow through, unfortunately, but hopefully they're able to.
Uh-oh, he froze up, Willie.
Looks like we might be having a little bit of internet challenges. I can jump back in with the weather. We've had a little bit more effect on our internet access around here. Oh, Willie, are you back?
Maybe camera off would be helpful where it's a bandwidth issue.
All right, hello all. Can you hear me now?
Yes, much better.
Okay, perfect. So not sure where I dropped out, but just again, real quick, we had 192 vaccinated at our first 5 to 11 year old clinic. One young kid, unfortunately, we weren't able to follow through with, so we're hoping they get a chance to reconsider and give it another try. And then we had a regular Moderna booster in the afternoon. We had 358 folks come in and get their Moderna booster, just for the general population adult boost there. We'll be back in Chimicum this coming Saturday. We still have about 50 spaces in the morning for 5 to 11 year olds. So do give us a call or go to the Jefferson County Public Health website to sign up for that. Again, we have 50 spots in the 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. time slot there in Chimicum. So if you're the parent of a 5 to 11 year old, we'd really encourage you to get out this Saturday. It is the last clinic we currently have on the schedule. We will have the second dose to complete the series early next month for the 5 to 11 year olds who got their first dose this weekend. But other than that, we're still kind of taking a step back to determine our path forward, which vaccine to offer and to which groups. And we're gonna be meeting over the next couple of weeks, and we'll make an announcement about December here. Relatively soon. So I think that was the one KPTZ question I had. Other than that, just want to thank all the kids who came out. We had a lot of real brave little troopers come, and I know needles are generally pretty scary. They scare me a little bit too. So we want to thank all the kids and their parents as well. You know, we had in our adult clinics, we even have some adults who get a little bit scared, a little bit nervous, and we have to herd those folks through the process and to herd both parents and their kids. It took a lot of cooperation and a lot of coordination. So I just wanted to thank everyone. We really do appreciate it. All the volunteers, the parents, the kids. So we'll look forward to seeing you back next weekend.
Great. I have one question. I'm not sure who it's for, but having spent some time on the other side of the country, I was noticing that boosters are much more widely available for, say, people our age in other parts of the country. Is that a state of Washington thing that we're keeping it at 65 and plus? Is that a Jefferson County thing? And when might we expect to have the booster available for other age groups?
That's actually supposed to be a federal thing. So if those are CDC recommendations about who should get the vaccine. So our pharmacies, our clinics are trying to follow those CDC recommendations. In other parts of the country, you might find people being a little looser with the booster vaccines. I have certainly heard that for those who really, really want one, that that there's not a lot of checking of whether or not you have a medical condition that makes you need a booster. If you go to, for instance, one of the pharmacies offering boosters, things like that. But I think what's key to know is right now they aren't technically approved for all people or recommended for all people, because we really have not seen that they are needed in the general population who's otherwise healthy. We really are seeing the fading efficacy being in elderly folks. And certainly we want that added protection for folks who are at high risk of severe disease or those who have immunodeficiencies. There's not a lot of indication for need in otherwise young and healthy folks. And there is a real issue with vaccine access worldwide. In many parts of the world, it's hard to believe living in the spaces that we do now, but in many parts of the world, only about 1-2% of the population are vaccinated. There are parts of the world where the healthcare workers are not fully vaccinated. And so we are trying to be thoughtful about how we distribute this vaccine so that we make sure our population is well protected. And part of that actually involves making sure the rest of the world is well protected as well. So we don't get new scary variants developing there that will then show up on our shores.
Yeah. Heidi, Greg, any questions?
Emily, today it's you're lucky.
I think you addressed one of mine about the age of boosters, because people in my age group have been asking me,
sure.
Can I get my booster now? And I'm like, I think it's still 65 and older, but and then some people I've said, I got my booster. I'm like, how'd you get your booster? So a little bit of a gray area there, I think.
Well, and there are a lot of folks who qualify for an underlying condition. You know, if you have hypertension, for example, that's a disease that puts you at risk for severe COVID-19, and a lot of us have that. And so if you have any of those underlying conditions that put you at risk for severe COVID-19, you qualify. So if you have a friend who's in their 40s, looks pretty healthy and got a booster, that might be why. Or if they are, if they work in a high-risk profession, you also qualify for a booster in those contexts. Or if you live in a high-risk area, if you live in a shelter, all of those who are living in shelters qualify for boosters. All of those currently living in jails qualify for boosters as well. So there's a lot of folks who are eligible, but I do want to stress that there's good reason to be confident in your vaccine. If you have an otherwise good functioning immune system, we do recommend you wear a mask if you're in those mixed settings where you don't know if other people are vaccinated, and wear a good quality mask if you're going to do a higher risk activity like, you know, getting on a plane, for example. But other than that, you really are quite well protected by your vaccine.
So I do have a few questions. And sure. One came from a couple of constituents who read the newspaper. And then the newspaper, there was the PDN, they had little pictures of people with their responses to a question. And one of the responses was around natural immunity. Mm. And I just was thinking maybe you could set the record straight on natural immunity. In the newspaper, this person was quoted saying, the shot gives artificial immunity and needs boosters. I caught the virus. It's like a bad cold, but now I have natural immunity. People have died from the shot. And I was thinking after I read that, after someone forwarded it to me twice, I know someone who contracted COVID in March of 2020. And he is still very impacted by it. So I guess he's what's being called a long hauler, but he has kind of extreme respiratory issues, is very lethargic sometimes and very achy sometimes. And the only thing he can attribute this to, I mean, he's super healthy. He's like a crazy bike rider. I mean, like mountain biking across the Olympics kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I feel like I'm not sure if this is misinformation around natural immunity. I have a hunch it is. I don't know, but can you set the record straight on that a little bit?
Happy to. So there's I would say that post does fall into the realm of misinformation. That may be that one person's experience with COVID, but the idea that is everyone's experience or what we all could expect if we got COVID, that's just not true. So there's kind of two parts of misinformation in that post. One is around the severity of COVID-19. And the severity of COVID-19 is highly variable in the population. Some people will get a mild cold and some people will die. And some people will get hospitalized for months. We have one of our citizens who's still hospitalized. I believe they've been hospitalized for over 3 months at this point with COVID-19. We have, looks like so far about 5% of those who get COVID-19 will get long haul COVID. will get symptoms that persist for months after they get COVID-19. Severe respiratory issues, fatigue, brain fog, persistent heart issues. So people who got inflammation of their heart from COVID who now have long-lasting heart failure from COVID that will likely last them the rest of their life. One of the things that I think is missing from the conversation when we talk about workforce shortages right now is that often we talk about that people aren't going back to work. What we don't talk about is that 750,000 Americans died of COVID, and that is actually part of our workforce shortage. Those are disproportionately frontline workers. And so we lost a ton of bus drivers. We lost a ton of truck drivers and healthcare workers and grocery store workers, and they have just died. So that pulled them out of the workforce. And then there's a whole other group that have persistent disability from contracting COVID-19 on the job. And that's the other thing that is causing these workforce shortages, these supply chain issues, is we have harmed a lot of our citizens with COVID-19. And so that, and I think for whatever reason, I'm not hearing that in the general public discussion. So COVID, long story short, can be incredibly severe. And it's highly variable. You don't know who you're going to be. You don't know if you're going to get a cold or if you're going to end up in the ICU. And that's actually something that we've seen with other severe infectious diseases before. So we talk a lot, I think people make the analogy to polio a lot. They're like, oh, well, of course we got vaccinated against polio. That was paralyzing people. Well, it was only paralyzing a proportion of people. Most people who got polio felt like they had a cold. But some of them ended up in iron lungs, and COVID-19 is actually very similar in that way. So do take it seriously. The National Geographic just put out a documentary about the first wave in New York. And I think sometimes it's good for us to recall back to that, of when so many people were dying of that. And at that point, we didn't have the vaccines we have now. We didn't have the ways to fix it. We have those now. That does not have to happen anymore. But we are still seeing that happen far too often because we're not using the tools available to us to prevent it. And then the other key thing to know is there was a couple pieces of misinformation about the vaccine and immunity there. So one was that they said people have died because of the vaccine. So no one in our community has died due to the vaccine. There have been on the order of less than 20 deaths associated with those severe clots related to the J&J vaccine. And that's it. No one else has died from their COVID-19 vaccine. I believe it's 11 nationwide. Compare that to, of course, the 750,000 who have died due to COVID-19. It's just they're not comparable as far as the risk associated with the two. The vaccine is incredibly safe. Very rare outcomes can happen when you apply a vaccine at a nationwide level, but the virus is much, much, much more dangerous. As far as immunity goes, so what we know now about immunity, so they are both natural immunity. There's immunity due to prior infection and immunity due to vaccination. They are both your body's immune system learning to respond to the virus. There's just two different ways to cause that to happen. One is your body gets exposed to the virus, and one is your body gets exposed to a vaccine. Now, comparing those immunities, the CDC recently did a really good review of all the available data on comparing immunity from both sources. What we see is that immunity due to prior infection is more variable compared to immunity due to vaccination. When you vaccinate a large group of people, you see a consistent antibody titer after they get vaccinated. If you expose a bunch of folks to COVID-19, they get COVID-19, you see a highly variable antibody titer. So some people are immune, some people aren't. The other thing that we know is immunity from prior infection fades. It goes away over time. It does not make you bulletproof to COVID-19 long-term. We think our best available data is that we can see that you are likely immune to COVID-19. I say likely because we don't know. You are likely immune to COVID-19 for up to 6 months after a prior infection, but then that immunity fades. And so if you have had COVID-19 in the past, we recommend you get vaccinated, because getting COVID and then getting vaccinated, if you survive that initial COVID infection, you will be very well protected against COVID-19 for the long term. But you do need to get vaccinated to get that kind of long-lasting immunity. With the vaccine, we do find that you need to get at least two doses if you're getting a two dose series. And then for some groups, we are recommending a booster. And then we see persistent protection from those as well. If you are unlucky enough to get a breakthrough infection, then you are very well protected if you have been vaccinated in advance. But both fade over time. And we have seen that the protection from a vaccine is much more consistent across the population than protection from prior infection, which is much more variable, depending on how severe your infection was and your age, likely. Long answer to your question, but hopefully that's
no, it. It's good. And I think it's good for people to hear. I mean, I remember you saying a lot of that before. I appreciate you bearing with us in the community with all of us coming at you with questions, and I really appreciate your response. My last question is back to my Thanksgiving dinner table.
Sure.
I feel like we should be on Lynn Rosetta Casper's. What was her Turkey Confidential?
Splendid table.
Splendid table. But this is the COVID Confidential Turkey conversation.
Sure.
So, we talked about. You know, the number, having people around a table and the efficacy of rapid antigen tests for being another level of protection. And I'm getting some pushback from some of my most beloved people saying those rapid antigen tests aren't very dependable.
Oh,
so I'm like, well, I think they are, but Dr. Barry, can you give us your recipe for a safe Thanksgiving with a rapid antigen test?
Absolutely. So, and this actually is a lot of us are planning making our Thanksgiving plans. So it's good to get into some detail about it. If you are going to have a Thanksgiving gathering, I do think it actually is very safe to have a fully vaccinated Thanksgiving gathering. So if everyone around that table is vaccinated, you're in a really good spot as far as safety. So that in of itself is the biggest safety step you need is for everybody coming to that Thanksgiving gathering to be fully vaccinated. And then you can enjoy your meal. The probability of COVID-19 getting into that space is incredibly low. So I think you really can do that quite well. If you're starting to incorporate some unvaccinated folks, say you've got some small children in the family who have not yet had access to vaccine. We have that situation in my family. If you are bringing one small unvaccinated child to an unvaccinated gathering and they haven't recently traveled on a plane or done some other high risk activity, you're still probably in good stead. But if you're going to start bringing multiple unvaccinated kids together for that gathering, that's a really good time to use rapid antigen tests. And the rapid antigen tests are very effective, actually. And we're going to be putting out some more messaging soon on there's a few brands that we know for sure that we use at the Jefferson County Department of Public Health and at the Washington State Department of Health. What the antigen tests do is they give you a really good idea of if you are infectious in the next 24 to 48 hours. So they're a really good thing for something like Thanksgiving dinner. You can have kids come in, get them swabbed on the way in, and you can feel really safe in that space for the rest of that night. Have a great Thanksgiving. Know you're not giving anyone COVID-19. That's a particularly good idea if you have kids traveling from across the country. So you've just taken an unvaccinated person on a plane, or if you have high-risk relatives that they're going to be coming near. So if you have a family member with significant heart disease or who's very elderly, who's going to be sitting around that table, doing an antigen test for especially anyone unvaccinated coming to that table is a really good idea. What I think there's probably some old information, I wouldn't say misinformation, but around the accuracy of antigen tests from back in the very beginning of the pandemic. What we have learned since then is that people shed non-viable virus for months after they have COVID-19, but they only shed infectious virus for about 10 days. In the antigen tests are really good at catching infectious virus. They're not good at catching that long tail of non-infectious virus that you shed for months and months, but that's not really meaningful virus. I don't need to know if you have non-infectious COVID. What I need to know is, do you have COVID you can give to somebody else? And the antigen tests are fantastic at that space. They're also, because they don't have amplification, which you see with a PCR, they're really only good for about 24 to 48 hours. And so you don't want someone taking an antigen test 5 days ago. That's not going to provide you any protection. But the good news is they, most of them result within about 15 minutes. And so it's a very easy thing to do when the kids come over. We actually recently used this. We were taking an unvaccinated small child to visit her grandfather who just had heart surgery. And so we just really wanted to be super safe. And so did that swab before she came in, knew she was negative. And everyone was good. So that's a really good way to keep folks safe at Thanksgiving. And those are my recommendations for a safe Thanksgiving celebration.
Thanks, Dr. Berry. That's the end of my questions.
Okay. Can I ask a follow-up, Greg, in case you're going to go to another topic?
Mine's a follow-up too, but after you.
Okay. Thank you. Any idea of the status of availability of rapid tests right now? Are they readily available or hard to find?
They are still intermittent, unfortunately. We're seeing they go in stock and then people buy them up. I would say as we move towards Thanksgiving, where I think more people will be using rapid antigen tests, it might be a good idea to plan for exactly how many you need. And if you see some, go ahead and pick some up, but please don't buy for, you know, the rest of the year, because we all need to share it as we go into the holiday season. But it's variable across the state. I know in places like the Seattle area where people are testing more, they're harder to find than they are actually even up here. It's a little bit variable.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, I'm just curious, following up on long COVID, it seems like there's a lot of different types of long COVID, and I'm wondering if it's time to parse that into a couple different definitions, you know, from Heidi's friend that is lingering, I'll say, you know, respiratory issues and lethargy, to the person that's been in the, you know, in the hospital for three months. I mean, these are both technically, I think, long COVID, but there's different types. And I guess I'm wondering if there's any move on creating a new vernacular to distinguish between these types.
Yeah, there is a lot of study going into long COVID right now. What we're seeing is a lot of it does depend on kind of the source of it. So there's one group of long COVID that we're seeing that is really primarily seems to be kind of a systemic inflammatory response to the virus. That's really what drives kind of persistent pain, lethargy, brain fog. But there's also a whole group who just were disabled by the initial virus. So they had myocarditis from COVID, or they had massive blood clots, pulmonary embolus, things like that, that have really, that in and of itself, the initial severe COVID infection has caused them to have significant disability. And that seems to be really the primary split. And then also the split along what organ system was affected. So we see it's primarily inflammatory in nature, but as we've learned, COVID does not just affect your lungs, it affects multiple organ systems. And so some people have persistent lung issues, like Heidi's friends, some people have persistent cardiac issues, some people have persistent neurologic issues. And that seems to be a lot of the breakdown is kind of what organ system is affected. I think it's important to note, we also do see long COVID in children. There is a common piece of misinformation I'm hearing that, you know, kids aren't affected by COVID. And one of the things we're seeing in these kids is mostly neurologic long COVID. So they have persistent learning difficulties, persistent pain and sensitivity. And I don't think any of us want to see that happen to a small child. And it does happen even to kids in this 5 to 11 range. And we really want to do everything we can to prevent that. And the vaccine does a really good job at preventing long COVID in these children.
Thank you.
All right. If we don't have any other commissioner questions, I can do a couple KPTZ questions. All right. So one person wrote about visiting a doctor's office. So they were in the waiting room, and although everyone was masked, they were worried about transmission in this highly used exam room without ventilation. Is this a concern? And particularly the exam room part. They also asked about kind of what masks people should be wearing, and why are folks in surgical masks and not in N95s or KN95s? Ventilation is a concern. So one thing to know is that even though you might not see ventilation, you might not see like windows open and things like that in doctor's offices, that is one space where a lot of work has been done on the actual systems of ventilation. So filtration on the HVAC system and things like that. So there may be more ventilation than you know in your medical office, but it is a really important space for good masking because people are sick there. And it is something that can happen. We have had occasions where a person was COVID-19 positive in a room, and then someone was roomed right after them, and then they got COVID from the room. We have gone over with our healthcare system clear infection control protocols for those situations. So now you may see sometimes if you go to your doctor's office that there's a room that's blocked off. That's actually because someone with COVID was in there. And so it's blocked off until all the particles have a chance to fall out of the air. Then it's cleaned before someone else comes in. But that is something we plan for. As far as masks for those spaces, surgical masks are really quite good for the vast majority of us. A KN95 does provide more protection. So if you can tolerate a KN95, that can be a really good option. Not everyone can. They block more airflow. And so for many folks with underlying respiratory issues, KN95s just aren't accessible to them. But if they work well for you, they can be a really good option in high-risk spaces. Other spaces that I definitely recommend a KN95, any kind of cross-country travel. So if I were going to get on a plane right now, I'd have a KN95 on, even though I'm a fully vaccinated individual, because that's a really important place to prevent that kind of transmission. Healthcare settings, the guidance is surgical masks for those. Primarily, a lot of that surgical mask it's protecting them. It's also protecting you. It's the source control so that if they ever got COVID, it would reduce the risk of you getting COVID from them. So that's that. We do have good evidence on the efficacy of surgical masks, but KN95 are a little more effective. So that can be a good option if they work for you. Other questions. So this person got their Moderna vaccine. They're fully vaccinated and they got vaccinated in March of 2021. They are eligible for a booster. So they met one of those booster qualifications and they are going to travel in February of 2022. They were wondering if they should put off their booster until closer to February. And I would say if you are eligible for a booster right now, I would recommend you get a booster now. We do know that our vaccines are showing good efficacy for the long term, particularly within 6 months after getting the vaccine. So it's November now. If you're traveling in February, you should be very well protected continuously from the booster. One of the big questions right now is, will boosters be needed in the future? And we can't know. But I would say that for many vaccines, it takes a couple doses in order to get long lasting lifelong immunity. So if you look at our pediatric vaccination series, often you get 2, 3, 4 doses and then never again for the rest of your life. I'm of the camp that I think our COVID vaccines are likely to go in that same way. So you might get 2, maybe 3 doses, and then you don't have to get any more. The big variable there is if another variant develops in other parts of the world, which is why it is so critical that we adequately vaccinate the rest of the world. Other questions. So this person had a question about isolation. So in blessedly, not that many of our citizens compared to our neighbors have gotten COVID-19, but you know, over 1,000 of us have. And so what happens if you get COVID-19? And of course, beyond getting appropriate medical care, one of the things that will happen is you'll get a call from the Department of Public Health, and we will ask that you isolate at home for 10 days from when your symptoms started. That is required. You do have to isolate. But what does isolation really look like? So really, what we're trying to do with isolation is we're trying to keep you from spreading COVID to other people. And that does not mean actually that you have to stay permanently in your house. You just have to stay away from other human beings. So I actually, when we give isolation recommendations, it's, if you haven't been in isolation yet, it is, it makes you really antsy. And so we encourage our citizens to stay healthy and continue to go for walks, get outside, breathe fresh air. That's good for them. It's good for their mental health. And as long as they stay far from other people, will not spread COVID-19. So if you happen to know that one of your neighbors has COVID and they're out for a walk, they are not breaking isolation protocols. What they do have to do is stay far away from other people. And so we talk about 6 feet, and certainly 6 feet outdoors is probably good enough, but give a wide berth. We encourage staying far, far from other folks if you have COVID-19, and of course wearing a mask if you came anywhere near another person. But you can go outside if you're in isolation. You just have to stay away from other people. Other questions. This was a parent who was talking about vaccination status of teachers in particular and risk to children. So our school teachers are required to either be vaccinated or to have an exemption on file. So they have to be a medical or religious exemption. You know, the vast majority of our teachers are actually vaccinated, but some have gotten the medical or religious exemption to not get vaccinated. As a parent, it is understandable to want to know whether or not your teacher is vaccinated. The school cannot divulge that information to you, but it is understandable desire as a parent. I would say that our teachers are much more vaccinated than most other professions, except for healthcare workers, actually. So it is a very safe place, and there are also lots of other protocols in place, like masking and distancing, to keep those kids safe. But there is a risk anytime you have an unvaccinated person in those spaces. That's true. That poses some risk. I do know the schools are working very hard to mitigate that risk. So if you are a teacher in Jefferson County and you are unvaccinated, you are required to get weekly testing to reduce that risk of transmitting COVID-19 to children. But it is very understandable as parents to want to know that information. If you have a good relationship with that teacher, you certainly are welcome to talk to them about it in a positive and collegial way. But it is it's an understandable concern, but as the health department and as the school, we can't divulge who's vaccinated and who's not. Otherwise, that I think was the last of my questions on that end. And it's a one other good reminder, which is that now all of our school age kids are eligible for COVID-19 vaccination. So the best way to protect your kids when they're going to school is to get them vaccinated as soon as possible.
Sorry, my computer blinked out for a minute there. I don't know if others did. Okay. Let's see, can you hear me all right? I'm getting a funny message. Okay, one quick question. Any vaccination clinics planned for after this weekend, Willie?
No, so I touched on that very briefly in my initial report. We do have the second dose clinics for the 2, 5 to 11-year-old clinics we were doing this weekend or this past weekend and next. So we will have those. But right now we're still assessing what the need is from the community, as well as what our capacity is right now. Both our teams at Public Health here at DEM and our volunteer crew are pretty ragged right now. So we need to be conscientious of what we're pushing them to accomplish. And we thankfully have a couple really great pharmacies here in the community. There are appointments available a little ways out. For folks who can be a little bit patient, those are available for you. And then there are walk-ins available every morning from Tri-Area Pharmacy. So as always, give us a call if you're having trouble finding something at a local pharmacy. And we'll make an announcement on our December clinics here in the next week or so.
Great. All right. Anything else for Dr. Berry or Willie Benz?
I do just want to add non-COVID related. It is going to be pretty windy and rainy out there, as it has been for most of the weekend. So the windiest periods will be over the next few hours, and then the rain will taper off hopefully by early evening. As always, report your power outages to the PUD. You can also check the outage map on their website. Just be cautious when traveling, especially if you have a high-profile vehicle. The winds will make it difficult. There are road closures, specifically in Clallam County, who've gotten hit a little bit harder than us. So just be aware and travel safely.
Thank you, Willie. All right. I think I'm going to need to restart my computer. So I'm going to suggest that we take a recess until 10:30. And thank you, Dr. Barry. Thank you, Willie.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.
And don't forget, a recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And again, thank you for listening. I'd like to thank Dr. Barry. I'd like to thank Willie Bentz and the commissioners for keeping up the good fight. Thank you.